I'm Karen Given, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. We wanted to bring this segment back after a three-month absence because there's so much to discuss, but we're going to do something a little different. Many leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement are saying that this is a moment for white people to do more listening than talking. So we've invited three guests to join us to talk about sports, racism, and police brutality, and I'm really just here to listen. We have a three-professor lineup today. Penn State Professor Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone, who also serves as Professor of the Practice at the University of Maryland. Welcome back to all of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Take it away, Amira Rose.
Yeah, so I have to admit that I'm a little bit of a cynic, and as inspiring as a lot of the images that have been circulating in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, as people have taken to the streets, have been very awe-inspiring in many ways. But when the corporate statements started rolling out, particularly when they were empty words paired with no action or, you know, downright hypocritical, I started side-eyeing a lot of things. So I have to admit, I was caught completely by surprise by NASCAR.
The Confederate flag, a fixture in NASCAR Southern culture for decades, now no longer permitted a place in the sport.
And I don't know what I'm feeling right now. It's like, is this like a little bit of hope?
Prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties, effective immediately.
I mean, if you remember in 2015, after the Charleston massacre, NASCAR said, hey, maybe you shouldn't bring Confederate flags to races. And that didn't hold. It still happened. So have in this moment, NASCAR say we're banning it outright, paired with constant activism by Bubba Wallace. He raced in a Black Lives Matter car this week. So this to me feels, I think, a little different. This is probably the first time in this moment that I've been genuinely shocked by what's happening. And I wanted to know if y'all were just as shocked as I was.
First, I was shocked to be reminded that Bubba Wallace was a brother. That's number one. I'm still wondering what was happening in his early life. I got to look into that. But I think what we need to think about all this, the Confederate statues coming down, the other symbolic things that are happening, is the symbolism of this. But with NASCAR, it's so ingrained as part of who they traditionally are. There is something really different about this. Now, you know, my big concern, the next big story is really enforcing it.
I would say I'm still a little bit cynical. You know, Bubba Wallace has been, he started in NASCAR in 2010. He was asked about this in previous years. And if I'm not mistaken, one of his quotes was, the only flag I care about in NASCAR is the checkered flag.
Diving more into it and educating myself, people feel uncomfortable with that. No one should feel uncomfortable when they come to a NASCAR race.
Josh Newman down at Florida State has written a lot about white supremacy, the Confederacy, and how it has been married into sports. And one of the things that he noted, I remember I wrote about this about 5 years ago, when NASCAR originally came out and said, you know what, don't bring your flags anymore. We're not really about that. They never checked their vendors. And so you could show up at a NASCAR event outside and you could buy whatever Confederate imagery you wanted and drench yourself in it and go right into the racetrack. So, you know, we'll see how well they police that. Are they going to actually be collecting flags at the door, taking caps off of people's heads, making them take off their t-shirts? I mean, I've covered NASCAR and it's everywhere. So we'll see how they handle.
Kevin, I really appreciate your point about Bubba's evolution. And I think that that's one of the things we're seeing is the rise of voices like Bubba Wallace and like lay players who perhaps were hesitant to say something before. Certainly, I feel that swell. And I have to ask, you know, Kevin, you've done a lot of work on this. When this happened, it was like, great. Now we're kind of cocking our heads and looking at the Washington football team.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's going to take the courage of football players of color to step up and say, no, this is not acceptable. Dan Snyder and this franchise and the NFL are not going to just roll over. But yes, Roger Goodell, if you're going to make a statement, don't have it be perfunctory by not backing it up and taking care of your own house.
Last thing I say is I think it also requires people to understand that anti-blackness and settler colonialism are wound tightly together. And so this is not, oh, a separate issue, et cetera, but it is to the very fabric of the march towards freedom.
Exactly.
Sounds like a good time to move on to Ken's topic.
Which I think all these topics are so interrelated. I'm the old business school guy, so I've been watching the corporate statements. It's different from any other time I think we've seen. Axios Sports did an analysis, you know, 2 weeks in, 118 of the 123 major sports teams in the U.S., the big four leagues, issued a statement. I mean, really kind of shocking that five had not by that point, James Dolan. And what's interesting to me is how many missed the mark. So the rare category, those who actually focus on police brutality, police misconduct, addressing racism directly rather than using language of diversity and inclusion. This is about police brutality, race, and murder. You can't find those words in most of these statements. For the reasons we understand, these sports leagues and teams are so intertwined with law enforcement that they can't call out their partner. Most striking, and Karen and I spoke about this earlier, was how long it took Major League Baseball amongst the leagues to step out, 9 days to say anything. And I've taken some time to think about that and why did that happen. But Major League Baseball, before they take this down, go to the Major League Baseball website and click on executives. And all you will see is white men standing around Rob Manfred. White men. 2020. And that's not historically the way that office has been. Bud Selig did much better. The NFL did move forward a bit because of the presence and the inclusion of more African-Americans in their organization.
I would say the thing that irritated me the most was not necessarily from MLB, but from individual franchises that all seemed absolutely stuck on using Jackie Robinson as their one black friend, which is no different than what the league does generally. It's no different than the way that they use the shield of Jackie Robinson and ignore the words of Jack Robinson, who will tell them about themselves. It was just so stark. They're taking quotes from him to say, we're all in this together. His story lights the way. Meanwhile, you know, Jack Robinson is over here writing 1965 about police power abuse. He has these articles reading. You can do it. It's there. But the constant like commitment to infantilizing him and to reducing him to this symbol so devoid of his actual life, to me, is annoying any year, all the time in general, but particularly now where I feel like it was giving certain franchises cover. The one thing that I will admit, a little pleased to see was the Red Sox statements affirming Torrey Hunter's experience.
Well, the Red Sox responding tonight to Torrey Hunter, who said he's heard racial slurs directed at him at Fenway Park over his 19-year career. And this is a very powerful statement. It says, quote, if you doubt him because you never heard it yourself, take it from us. It happens.
And then they went a step further to say, and it's also experience that our black employees at Fenway experience. And I was not super, like mildly impressed, like a half step too impressed by this statement in the fact that it affirmed Torrey Hunter, but also because it recognized the abuse that their employees get at the very same stadium.
Yeah. And what all this reminds me of is that, you know, most people have an impression of sports in this country as being in the vanguard of social change. And it's even embedded deep in the psychology of black athletes. We can even look back to 2016 when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee that August. From that point for the next several years, you could almost count on your fingers and toes how many black athletes actually followed him in his protests, with the exception of one weekend when everyone responded to President Trump's calling them. But it also got co-opted. Owners got involved in it. Jerry Jones pulled a little trick.
Jerry Jones and his Cowboys all taking a knee before the national anthem.
In what seemed a choreographed move, the team stood up, went to the sidelines, and linked arms for the Star-Spangled Banner alongside their...
So sports is this vanguard of social change. Really not true. Has been a laggard. And, you know, I would also argue, since we started out talking about the Confederate flag and and Bubba Wallace, there's no corner of American society that has done more to promulgate Confederate imagery than sports. NASCAR, Southern College football.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I really appreciate you bringing up that one weekend where, you know, Jerry Jones got his photo op kneeling. Because honestly, the last 2 weeks has kind of felt like that weekend, right? Where there was an interest convergence with multiple motivations coming to bear. Some of it sincere, others motivated by something else. And I keep waiting for it to pass, waiting for that Monday. And I think that thinking about what the actionable steps are, thinking about how we resist corporations becoming like Nike, and all of a sudden you have, you know, Colin in a video, no mention of police brutality, no mention of the kind of core central issues, but all of a sudden creating a space where you're buying Nikes, you're a revolutionary. And that slippage is very easy. If the next step for NASCAR and MLB, et cetera, is another diversity and inclusion initiative, another false partnership where you're going to give all this money to an organization that's going to cut the dreads off of Black boys and call it progress, that's what's coming down the pipe. And so how do we take this moment and figure out how to guard against that and continue to push this moment of interest convergence towards where we want sports to be?
All right, Kevin, I think it's a good time to move on to your topic.
Yeah, well, that is kind of my topic. You know, the name of this show is really an oxymoron for people of color, right? You know, growing up in Washington, D.C., my father was a sports fan, my mother was a sports fan, but sports from a very early age, yeah, I wanted my local teams to win, but it was more than just a game. My father and his friends had boycotted the Washington football team in the late 1950s. They had season tickets and started going to watch Baltimore Colts games. And the reason was because the Washington football team had a racist owner who was determined to keep this team, the last all-white team, in the NFL. And there are black and white pictures of the Nazis with placards marching and in full uniform marching outside of DC Stadium as it's being constructed, with placards imploring Washington to keep its football team all white. So I remember my father telling me stories about boycotting the games. And then once the team integrated, it continued to be drenched in the Confederate imagery that it used to sell itself to the South, because it was the southernmost team in the NFL at the time. And one of the things that they did was the band used to play Dixie, and it would sometimes bring out Confederate flags in the stands. And my father wrote a letter to the acting president of the team at the time, who was Edward Bennett Williams. My father pointed out to him this practice. He said, why are we celebrating a dead society? It's a slap in the face to black ticket buyers and sometimes causes fights in the stands. And to Edward Bennett Williams's credit, he wrote my father back and said, thank you for bringing that to my attention. We will end that practice right now. And to the best of my knowledge, Confederate imagery was removed from the home games of this team. So that's one, to show that you can do the right thing and move ahead, but two, to show just how important sports are to people of color. The imagery, this story about it being a meritocracy where the color of your skin doesn't matter. You know, as I've gotten older, I just can't sit down and just enjoy a game. I joke with some friends of mine, okay, let's watch this game without polemics. But it's hard to do because it means something particularly different to me as a person of color than I think to people who have been able to grow up with sports as just something to enjoy devoid of politics.
Yes, certainly. I think that historically it has occupied that space because of the possibilities. I'm thinking, as a sports historian, of course, you know, Jack Johnson was so effective because at a time where scientific racism was rampant and you're saying black people are inferior in every aspect, you can't keep that same energy if Jack Johnson is knocking people out in the ring. I think about 68 a lot for a number of reasons, obviously, but I think about one of the things that black athletes were saying when they were thinking about boycotting because of the inclusion of South African Rhodesia. One of the biggest things that athletes, men and women, were saying was that we're not going to get an audience at the UN to talk about what's going on in our country. We're not going to get a press conference in the Rose Garden. But the one way that white America understands and sees Black people is through sports, which occupies such a space in our society. So we're going to take this platform. We're going to take the moment that we know that they can't look away because they're cheering us on. And we're going to use that to speak out. This is our press conference. This is our moment in front of the UN. And so that platform that sports gives always compels it to be more than a game.
I tell you, one of the most obscure Hall of Fame speeches was given by one of the greatest tight ends of all time, Kellen Winslow Sr. The entire speech was about the need for affirmative action in sports, in football in particular. And Kellen's an old friend. I said, you know, man, why'd you do that? He said, well, I knew this was the last time anybody's going to listen to me. He recognized in the way that Cap recognized, in the way that Kevin's father recognized, that this vehicle is so important. The one story I thought about when you were talking about your father, Kevin, and you know, you're not going to make me cry in this on this show, was my grandfather, who was born in 1893 in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. And he came to live with us in the 60s. And he was a rabid Dodgers fan because of Jackie Robinson. And if anybody tipped me into rooting for the team with the most Black players, rooting for the team with the Black coach, for seeing sport is good when it treats us the right way, it was from my grandfather. And the Jack, you know, Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, those moments and all the stories, especially the Louis of people on the stoop listening to the Louis Schmeling fights and all that sort of stuff, was really just a part of our culture and a part of our unity that in many ways had us over buy into sport and over buy into this success story. You know, we can make it, and look, somebody made it, you know, Jackie made it. So I always say we have to be very careful about how we use sport, how we accept sport as a space for success, especially today with all this going on, with all this activity, with all the power LeBron has. LeBron will not be on that platform forever. There'll be a day when he's not playing anymore. The most vivid picture in sport, and I used to have it kind of posted on my wall all the time, was the day that Michael Jordan got fired from the Washington Wizards. When he wasn't playing, the ownership said, you know, we don't really need you anymore. It can happen to anybody in sport at any time. And that's kind of how we fit within sport. And I didn't cry.
Kevin, do you want to wrap it up?
This has been a fabulous conversation, important conversation, because there's a lot of noise out there about what's going on right now and what sports mean. I think everybody here really brought the importance of this moment, brought it out, and underscored the fact that there's still so much more to do. This is just the beginning. There's a lot still to be done with this conversation.
Wow, that was amazing. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Penn State professor and Burn It All Down co-host Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone. Thanks again to all of you.
Thank you always for having me.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
There was a lot more to that conversation that we just didn't have time for in the show. So we're going to release a longer version, twice as long, as a podcast bonus. You can find it now in the Only a Game feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Stefania Ergamlitsa wanted to bring a portable basketball hoop to Minneapolis as a way to ease tensions. But there was a problem.
Flights, easy. A hotel, easy. How in the world do I get a basketball hoop to Minneapolis?
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.